Hello, everyone. This is Fahim Nurali, the Climate Finance Trade Commissioner based out of the Embassy of Canada in Washington, D.C. This is our third podcast reflecting on the Climate Finance Roundtable held in late May, virtually and hosted by the Embassy of Canada. In the first two sessions, we focused on the supply and demand of capital in climate finance. In the first session, we listened to investment officers from notable institutions talking about what it takes for a project to get investable. And in the second session, we heard from entrepreneurs as to what it's like to work with these investors to demand the capital that is needed for their projects. This session, I'm really excited about because we have the global thought leaders around blended finance in international finance institutions talking about how blended finance can help bridge that supply and demand gap. Here, we'll learn what blended finance is and what it isn't, and get examples of where blended finance has played a catalytic role in bridging this gap between the supply and demand of capital in climate finance. When we initially taped this series, there were some technical difficulties, and we've tried to edit it out for the purposes of this podcast. So if you hear any skips in the audio, that is why. So I hope you enjoyed this session. It was really informative, and I was really happy as to how the session came out and the results of this session, and I hope you are too. Please provide me with any comments through the podcast or by messaging me directly. Enjoy. Yesterday, we first heard from investors like from FinDev, IDB Invest, and IFC on what an investable pipeline looks like and how investors are approaching emerging markets, opportunities in emerging markets. They noted that they are keen to invest in projects that are financially viable and speak to their impact priorities, such as climate and gender. It is important, however, to be patient, as these are conversations that lead to relationships. This was followed by a session where a Canadian project developer, JCM Power, and a Canadian impact investor, Beacon Impact, both of whom have strong partnerships with the IFIs, shared best practices in their approach. Not surprisingly, there was an emphasis on team, ensuring that climate and gender interests are well integrated into the plan and getting management buy-in. The role of technical assistance to help companies as well as having local capabilities is important from both the investment platform and project development perspective. Overall, our investors and entrepreneurs look to answer this question, and we'll look to do it again today. If there's so much money in climate finance, what does it take to get deployed? Today, our panel will explore how innovative finance, and particularly blended finance, can play a role in closing that gap. And tomorrow, we'll discuss the policy foundations from the US and Canadian government that help create an enabling environment. So to that end, I'm really excited about our panel today, as they're global experts on DFI blended finance and have collaborated across corporate lines to make sure that blended finance is impactful. We're fortunate that our moderator, Chris Club, CEO of Convergence Finance, has a working relationship with our panelists today, and so I'm looking forward to this in-depth conversation. Joining Chris is a superstar roster consisting of Griskaya Sierra Escalante, Senior Manager for Blended Finance at the International Finance Corporation, or IFC, Matteo Pigon, Head of Blended Finance at IDB Invest, and Robert Proby, Private Sector Development Advisor at the Foreign, Commonwealth, and Development Office of the UK government.
Thank you very much. So everybody, as Fahim says, I think you should all be very pleased to hear that we have three of the world's leading practitioners and experts in blended finance participating in this phone call today. Kruskaya, Rob, and Mathieu are really leaders amongst their organizations and really in the international development community on blended finance. My name is Chris Club. I'm from a group called Convergence Blended Finance. We are 100% dedicated to mobilizing higher levels of investment to developing countries to implement a higher number of SDG projects through this activity we call blended finance. And I'd really like to thank the Government of Canada from the outset of our existence for being the anchor funder. We have a variety of funders right now, but without the Government of Canada, certainly we would not be here to speak to you. So very briefly, I'm going to set up a little bit of context for blended finance. We think that the world's leading definition for blended finance is really which was adopted by the biggest contributors of funding to blended finance. The OEC Development Assistance Committee members 3 years ago agreed a relatively broad definition, And it's really this whole idea of deploying funding that has development as its core ambition. Okay. And there's two types of official development finance in blended finance. There's funding deployed by Mathieu and Kruskaya from their organizations as examples, where they're looking to allocate their capital and their funding pursuant to a market-based return. And then there's other funding that can be allocated on more catalytic, more concessional terms, and possibly below market. And Rob from the UK FCDO and other organizations, what are known as development agencies or donors, are very active in allocating these two types of funding. But ultimately, both of these types of funding are doing an intentional objective of development impact, but also ultimately trying to mobilize a higher level of private investment to these SDG projects in blended finance. Next slide, please. So, and why is this required? Broadly speaking, when we look at the 145 developing countries, the median country risk there, as proxied by the sovereign risk rating, is single B. And a lot of private investors, if we're looking at allocating capital pursuant to a debt decision-making process, if we've all taken Finance 101, this on the right-hand side is the capital asset pricing model. And a lot of the time, debt investors look at debt investments in developing countries, and they see an investment that falls below this market efficient line. So therefore, blended finance can do one of two things. It can create a market equivalent investment opportunity for a private investor by doing one of two things. It can either reduce the risk, i.e. moving it from A to B and getting it to this market efficient line, or it can actually increase the return, moving it from A to C, once again, getting it to the market efficient line. As we sit here in 2020-21, the large majority of blended finance is about altering the risk. And one of the leading reasons is we in the development community and blended finance community have seen over the last 20 years a big difference between the perceived risk of investing in these markets and the actual risk. Next slide, please. Now, blended finance, broadly speaking, can be undertaken either at a project level or at a portfolio level. We're going to spend this slide just on a project level. So this can be an individual loan or equity investment to an individual project, like let's say an independent power project in sub-Saharan Africa, 100 megawatts. There's certain things that could be done to move that project from near bankable to bankable through blended finance. And there's a variety of activities here on these five or six sub-bullets here. But the primary tool or instrument used is a guarantee or insurance products that would ultimately alter the risk return for the senior debt provider most often to move their debt investment from being unacceptable to acceptable because the project is being moved from near bankable to bankable. Next slide, please. But most blended finance as practiced in 2021 is actually deployed at a portfolio level. And we're going to give you here a typical portfolio approach and portfolio blended finance structure whereby investors invest into a blended finance vehicle, often a fund, and this fund could have multiple tiers of capital. And in the most senior tier or tiers, we're trying to mobilize private investors. And in a junior tier or tiers, these development organizations are allocating capital. And through the art of diversification and subordination, this approach can credit enhance a series of individual projects that might be single B, indeed triple C, that by aggregating them together and tiering this capital, we can create investments that are market equivalent and meet the risk criteria of these institutions. So that's a little bit of a brief background on blended finance, but now I really want to move into our panel, who are excellent practitioners at this. I'm going to move us through. I'm going to ask on maybe Kruskaya to introduce yourself first, and then Mathieu right after Kruskaya, and Rob right after Mathieu. Kruskaya?
Thank you very much, Chris, as always. And thank you, Fahim, and the Embassy of Canada for the invitation. It's always a pleasure to have the opportunity to discuss. I'm Kruskaya Sierra Escalante, Senior Manager and Acting Director of the Blended Finance Department in IFC. As many of you know, IFC is the private sector arm of the World Bank. Within IFC, you know, blended finance is a separate department. We use this separate structure to ensure that we are managing, you know, the funds that we are entrusted by either multilateral facilities or bilateral donors in a way that it is, you know, alongside the strict governance and in alignment with some principles that together with Matthew and many other DFIs, we have agreed to implement in our blended finance transactions. At IFC, we have been using blended finance for more than 15 years. It started very small with around 40 million under management from the Global Environment Facility. So most of our experience is on the climate space. And now we basically manage about 5 billion. A lot of what we have today under management is directed to the lowest income countries and fragile situations. Lots of learning there of, you know, how do you change the structures? How do you move from single projects to these broader, you know, structures that Chris was talking about? And I am looking forward to having the opportunity to engage on some more specific questions on that, Chris. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Matthew.
Hi, everyone. Hi, Chris. How are you? Hi, Fahim. And thanks for the Embassy of Canada for having me today. My name is Matthew Pegon. I manage blended finance at IDB Invest. IDB Invest is the private sector arm of the IDB Group, a regional development bank that has been active in Latin America and the Caribbean for the past 60 years. Within IDB Invest, we provide financing. We provide financing to companies that are active in the region, be it in energy and infrastructure space, financial institutions, or corporates. We have a dedicated blended finance unit, which I manage. We manage approximately 800 million of third-party resources that we deploy in projects in the region in accordance to the principles that Kruskaya just mentioned. Happy to be here.
Thank you, Matt and Rob?
Yes, hello, Chris. I hope you can see and hear me okay. Very good to be here. Thanks very much to Fahim and the Embassy of Canada for the invitation. As Chris had explained, my name is Rob Probyn. I head up the mobilization team in the private sector department at the UK's Foreign, Commonwealth and Development Office, which was formed last year through the merger of the UK Department for International Development and the UK's Foreign Office. So what we've done is bring together our development and diplomacy capability into a single department. So as I say, I head up the mobilization team here. And you know, when we talk about mobilization, we are focusing explicitly on mobilizing private finance, getting private finance to invest in emerging and frontier markets in a way that has a positive SDG impact. And blended finance has a strong role to play here in supporting this type of mobilization. We've put a range of interests in different sectors and different tools to develop in this area. But I would say that in this year in particular, the year in which kind of the UK government is hosting the COP climate conference in Glasgow, we're particularly focused on mobilizing climate finance, which makes me doubly pleased to be able to join this event.
Thanks very much, Rob. Now, as me as moderator, I'm going to ask some questions to the panel members, but please get your questions into the chat box because we're going to try to get them to them as soon as practical. So, Rob, maybe we'll continue with you. You mentioned climate. When we look at UK government hosting COP26 in November coming up, we look at a lot of the initiatives from the private investor community, including the Net Zero Asset Owner Alliance and this idea of climate finance or ESG investment or green finance. It's such an incredibly important type of financing to be mobilizing. Walk us through a little bit the UK government's, you know, views of COP26 and this COP26 blended finance platform, whereby you're trying to increase both donor commitment, but also private investment to achieve these objectives. Rob?
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Chris. So just to start off with kind of a little bit about kind of COP26, like I think we all understand the kind of the pressing nature of the climate emergency that is heading our way. And in the UK, we are kind of absolutely determined to make COP26 kind of a real turning point in the way we are approaching climate change and our response to it. And we see finance thing as being kind of absolutely kind of front and center to that response. So we have a COP26 kind of finance campaign with a number of pillars, kind of one of which is kind of specifically globalization, which I'll talk about shortly. But just to say the kind of the ultimate goal here in our approach is to ensure that climate features in every significant kind of financial decision that is taken, which is obviously kind of very ambitious, but that's where I think we need to get to have an appropriate response to the scale of the issue. In terms of, Chris, you specifically kind of referenced the COP26 blended finance platform. This is kind of one of the initiatives that we are taking forward in order to drive kind of the mobilization of private climate finance. The goal here is to bring together the key stakeholders who can deliver scaled up kind of financing into those projects in developing countries that need it. And across the piece, that means the kind of institutional level investors, the scale of which means that really we need to be targeting institutional investors because of the hundreds of trillions of dollars globally kind of they have. So there's a huge kind of there is this kind of this huge volume of finance available, but the way to get it into the types of climate projects in the developing countries we're targeting does require support through blending. So the other key stakeholders here are MDBs and DFIs, but also the donors, the bilateral agencies you were talking about, Chris, who have the concessional capital to make the blending work. And of course, the fund managers, project sponsors, who will be who are fundraising, who need the funding to get these projects, the projects off the ground, and then in terms of funding vehicles and portfolios, who are developing structures for kind of institutional investors. So what we're hoping to do, the drive of the COP26 blended finance platform is to bring together these key stakeholders and support, in particular, fundraising for blended finance vehicles and structures at scale. Kind of recognizing that in order to bring institutional investors, what we need are large scale platforms, hundreds of millions of dollars plus, which require commitment from all those stakeholders. So kind of in brief, Chris, that's what we're aiming to do with the COP26 blended finance platform. We're aiming to raise the awareness around the role blended finance can play and support fundraising of blended finance vehicles in the run-up to COP26 in particular.
Thank you very much, Rob. Just to give everyone an order of magnitude, Rob mentioned scale. Convergence has the world's largest database of blended finance transactions, and the average size has been around 65 million of financing for each transaction. So if we're trying to move at scale, that we need to have a handful or a couple handfuls of vehicles that are quite largish, and Rob and his colleagues are doing excellent efforts to try and make that happen. Now, maybe moving on to Krishkai. For all of you who don't know, Krishkai is probably the world's leader amongst MDBs and DFIs for climate solutions. She's been at this for a long period of time. And Krishkai, as we all know, IFC does an excellent job of providing financing to many projects over the course of a year in developing countries, both debt and equity, all in the private sector. Maybe, Krishkai, walk us through maybe an example and maybe a little bit of logic within the IFC and World Bank Group of, you know, which particular projects can you be funding with your own resources versus those where you're actually partnering with donors in a blended finance structure to also mobilize investment. Maybe walk us through the rationale between the difference and maybe an example. Krishkai?
Thank you, Chris, for the opportunity. It's also sometimes rare to make this comparison because either you get in a panel with blended finance or you are talking about IFC's on account investment. But this is a very good question. Just to give you a sense of the magnitude, only about 10 to 15% of what IFC does on an annual basis is supported by blended finance. When you go into some of the most difficult places, if you think about some of the agricultural projects in Africa, then we're talking about 40, 50% of those projects and bigger structures as well, supported by blended finance. So I think for us, it's key to make that differentiation. The main aspect, I believe that, you know, we look at it, and this is again part of the work that we have done together with the other DFIs, is to think about the reason for blended finance. What is the market challenge? What is the market failure that we are trying to help solve with the use of blended finance? If that market failure is not apparent, then, you know, commercial financing, including from IFCs on account investments, should be the first, port of call and the solution. Within IFC, we think about these market failures perhaps in two broad categories. You know, some of them are very clear about, you know, the de-risking needs. There is just too much, and you spoke about it, Chris, either a very high perception of risk or actual risk that needs to be managed. And then, you know, basically we link this to the participation constraints that this causes. You know, then other cases, the issue is affordability. In particular, we have seen with, you know, in the past with technologies that are considered to be relatively new and expensive, you need to have some level of support, at least at the beginning, until technological advancements and new business models come in. So for us, this idea of de-risking or help rebalancing the risk reward are very important. I want to add one additional element that we look at it from a blended finance perspective, and is when we are trying to incentivize something that is not being done. And for us, this has been particularly helpful in the area of climate change. And we have a program with respect to green buildings and green mortgages with the UK government that is trying to create a transformation, including through the creating incentives for developers to certify their buildings as green buildings. So, you know, from that perspective, you know, you think about de-risking, managing some of the, I will say, challenges from an affordability criteria, and also incentivizing. Once you have decided that's the, you know, there is a good reason to provide blended finance, then you get into the more technical aspects, you know, of it, which is how do you minimize concessionality? And that's our second principle that, you know, we follow as DFIs. The third one, you know, it's about how do you stay, you know, true to blended finance to be a temporary solution. If we need subsidy forever, perhaps this is not the role of a private sector arm of a development bank. You know, maybe the public sector or the government should be thinking about that. Also, another very important aspect of what we do, Chris, is thinking about what else is needed. Sometimes blended finance can be the solution, but many times it's the enabling environment, the capacity of the sponsor, and you need to have these other aspects of it. And finally, for us, transparency and good governance is key. And I spoke to you, and you know, Matthew also mentioned this idea that we have separate teams that are looking at it from a fiduciary perspective, and also that we are being very transparent as a DFI community, putting an annual report of our activities. Now for, you know, 4 years we have put that, and also as individual MDBs putting a lot of information out. In the case of IFC also, you know, we include, you know, a calculation of the level of concessionality that we provide in these transactions or in these bigger platforms. So I'll stop there, Chris.
Thank you, Chris. I just want to point out to everybody on this phone call that the MDBs and DFIs came together and adopted principles that they've all agreed that they'll deploy when they're considering when and how to use blended finance. So I really applaud the MDBs and DFIs for doing that, and in turn are reporting on that. Matthew, I'm going to ask you a question, but Kruska and Matthew, I'm just forecasting for you. Wilson Pierce has a question in this box. Okay, I'm going to come back after my question to Matthew, with expecting the MDB practitioners to have a little bit of an answer. Matthew, yourself at IDB Invest and the Canadian government have had an excellent relationship in the Canadian Climate Fund since 2012. Can you explain to the audience how this partnership has supported IDB Invest to undertake projects it could otherwise not undertake, and maybe provide one or two actual examples? That would be great. Matthew?
Yeah, good question. So, you know, we've been working with Canada since 2012. They've entrusted us approximately $450 million of third-party funds to do blended finance. It is one of our largest donor. And, you know, one reason why this has been such a great relationship, I think, is within a set of predetermined parameters, which is, you know, we want you to go the extra mile when it comes to climate adaptation and climate mitigation. We want you to include gender consideration in your investments. So, you know, this is not a free lunch by all means, but within that set mandate, there was a recognition that, you know, in order to accelerate market developments, you need to be cognizant and accept the fact that market has changed, are changing, and that, you know, opportunity may arise in one country as opposed to another. And when you think about the additionality of regional institutions doing blended finance, a lot of it is really about those inter-country or regional spillovers that you're going to be creating. So if there's a window of opportunity to set up a new renewable energy framework in Uruguay, that's going to be that's going to trickle down to Mexico and Colombia, and in turn trickle down to other countries. And that flexibility, I think, has really been the key success factor in deploying those funds. I've mentioned Uruguay previously. It's an interesting example. You know, a couple of years ago, what we think today as being obvious wasn't. So it wasn't that obvious to finance a solar farm in those countries, and it was not economically profitable. But so with the Canadian Fund, we financed the first four solar plants in the country. And what's sort of interesting, looking back at those projects, is that all those projects have been subsequently refinanced by the market through most of them through a project bond, a structure, and the Canadian Fund was completely taken out of the structure. What it also means, and sorry, I'm going to go a little bit technical there, but the subsidy that we had provided at the time in order to make this transaction economical for the sponsor, the client was able to refinance this transaction on the market. And if they done so, and if it was profitable for them to do so, that means it was more attractive for them to refinance today at the current market rate than it was 5 years ago and the subsidized rate. And I think that's a case in point of what blended finance is aiming to achieve. So it's really sort of moving the needle in terms of commercial sustainability and being able to create asset classes that in the past were not fully bankable and now are fully bankable. And that's really where you sort of unlock the billion to trillion. So it's not necessarily the leverage in the individual transaction, but really what impact is your transaction having on the market.
Thank you, Mathieu. I think you identified the two key components of blended finance: the financial additionality. Why is this concessional catalytic funding needed in the first place? And ultimately, even more important than that is the development additionality. What are we actually achieving from a development perspective that is additional? So I'm going to briefly go through. Sky, you've probably read the question. Okay. Not sure you probably haven't. So we have a question from Wilson Pierce, who is at Sogema Technologies. And Sky, if you've had a chance to read that question.
It's a very interesting question. I think just for those that have not seen it, the way that I understand it is that, you know, usually we're talking about using these small amounts of public funds to support private sector investments that then at some point in time, as Mathieu was saying, become commercial. Question is, does sometime, you know, the private sector investment comes first and then, you know, you get a public sector or a blended structure? And I probably would say that that's a rare situation, but one thing that you could do is a private sector investor come in early on, perhaps is a proof of concept, and then you want to scale it up. And if you want to scale it up, you may need to have, you know, this idea of having a tranche of, you know, blended finance that is supporting that. So that's one of the examples that I see. Of course, the other thing that, you know, I tend to see is if there is significant macro situations that, you know, create market challenges that are enormous. And I think COVID-19 gives us a little bit of that preview in which markets that before potentially didn't need blended finance, we see that now there is a role and a very strong role for us in terms of liquidity and, you know, rescuing jobs that otherwise will be lost.
Yeah, Wilson, I would completely agree with Chris Guy. The scenario you paint is relatively rare. Where I have seen it is where sometimes infrastructure projects require around 12 years of tenor of financing, right? and you have public sector entities providing the longer tenor and the private sector entities maybe providing a shorter tenor. And rarely, sometimes there's a bullet there, and if it gives the option of the private investors to leave the transaction at the maturity. But that's quite rare. Kruskaya's example is more akin to public sector, quote unquote, blended finance coming in first to maybe de-risk a project. And then ultimately, as the projects become less risky, private investment coming in. I'm going to move on to, please, the questions, keep the questions coming. You know, Rob, I'm going to come back to you now. You know, Rob, as you know, Kruskaya and Mathieu represent two of the world's leading multilateral development banks. Can you please maybe identify some good blended finance vehicles that the UK government has funded that channel finance and investment to climate projects that may not involve MDBs and DFIs? For example, you know, the UK has funded the Pidge Group and Garantco. Canada has recently joined Garantco. Maybe give one or two examples for the audience.
Yeah, sure, Chris. I'm very happy to do that. And also very happy to take the opportunity to welcome Canada's support for Garantco as well. Just to give like a kind of a very quick bit of background for kind of any in the audience that might not be familiar with Garantco. So it's a company in the private infrastructure development group in which the kind of the UK has a significant shareholding that is designed to mobilize kind of private investments into sustainable and inclusive infrastructure in sub-Saharan Africa and South and Southeast Asia. So kind of what the Pidge group of companies does is it kind of operates actually across the project life cycle and across the capital structure to help projects overcome kind of challenges, financial, technical, and environmental challenges, with the goal absolutely of creating a kind of investment-ready, bankable infrastructure opportunities. I just want to emphasize this point, which I think Kruskaya and Mathieu have already kind of brought out, that the role of blended finance here is absolutely about delivering a kind of commercially viable investment opportunities, taking projects that are near bankable and getting them across the line. So just to talk a bit more about a kind of Pidge, there are it has a couple of kind of investor and developer companies, Infraco Asia and Infraco Africa, that kind of originate and develop projects. They get involved at kind of an early stage, taking early stage risk and taking projects kind of up to financial close. But I think another couple of the companies in the Pidge group that are relevant here when we talk about blended finance, like in particular, is Garantco, which provides kind of local currency guarantees, essentially supporting banks and bond investors that come in with kind of local currency investments. Which of course provide financing for projects and also have the additional benefit of developing local capital markets. And also just the reference that another company in the Pidge group is the kind of Emerging Africa Infrastructure Fund, which provides kind of long-term foreign currency loans. And actually just reference, picking up on that point that Chris made, often what the EAIF will be able to do is to provide much longer tenor loans that might be available kind of commercially. Chris, you suggested kind of I give a couple of examples. So one of the ones I'm going to reference is the Acorn Affordable Student Housing Project in Kenya. There's a huge unmet demand for kind of a student housing in Kenya because of the growth of the education sector. Obviously, been enormous over the last few decades, but there are constraints in the local capital market limiting kind of avenues for kind of infrastructure financing. So what's happened there is that the Pidge Group has come in, provided some TA. The Emerging Africa Infrastructure Fund has provided some medium-term financing. But also what Garantco has done is come in to provide a partial credit guarantee, supporting raising financing for the project, with the result being a kind of a B1 rating for Moody's at financial close in November 2019. That was above the sovereign rating, and let's say enhanced demand kind of from investors. And just to make the point there actually about Garantco providing kind of a partial credit guarantee, again, comes back to blended finance being kind of, I see it as being a kind of a journey towards genuine kind of commercial viability, where these types of projects, this financing can be done without the need for this sort of support. So part of Garantco's, the way Garantco would work is to come in with a partial credit guarantee, but then hope in a similar market to perhaps be doing a similar project kind of next time round, but with a smaller guarantee. So guaranteeing kind of less and less of the amount of financing, of course, with the ultimate goal of being Garanco falling away altogether as local capital markets kind of develop in order to essentially make Garanco redundant. I'll leave it there for the moment.
Thank you very much, Rob. I just want to emphasize that one, that blended finance in the short term is trying to mobilize private investment with a little bit of concessional catalytic capital. But as Rob rightly identifies, in the medium and long term, that hopefully will demonstrate that this concessional catalytic capital is not required, and you actually have an underlying fundamentally good commercial investment there. Kruska, I'm going to move on to you. You know, if you all don't know this, the World Bank Group and the what are known as the International Development Assistance donors all came together around 5 years ago and really created a pool of $2.5 billion, really to support the low-income countries out there, what's known as the IDA countries, and what's now known as the private sector window. Maybe Kruskaya, can you walk us through one or two examples of how IFC itself is engaging with the World Bank and the IDA donors to do things in low-income countries that it otherwise could not do now that the private sector window is available? Kruskaya?
Chris, thank you very much. So in 2017, as you say, this idea of working together with other parts of the World Bank Group came and to provide these resources. Until then, most of the resources that we had available for blending were in the climate space. And where we were doing mostly mitigation projects were in the middle income countries. So the idea was to, you know, move us to do more things in the most difficult countries using some of the techniques that we had learned and the structuring that we had learned through the blended finance. You know, when you look at this, what you end up seeing is that we have changed quite a lot what we do. In the past, a lot of the structures were lower interest, you know, rates and a lower interest loans. And, you know, there is a question there about that, about the subsidized rates. And usually, you know, it was the development partners that gave us this money that would allow us to do a co-investment that was concessional. With the IDA private sector window, we really have increased the number of what we call de-risking structures. A lot more that has come on the subordinated loans, equity, also equity at larger scale, and you know, these very innovative transactions that are broader through pool first loss guarantees. So, you know, the way that we have been thinking, you know, is a little bit different. The other thing that we realize is, again, the concessionality that the most difficult places and low-income countries require is higher than what you will see in some of the middle-income countries. So, you know, the IDA private sector window has opened up some of these potential solutions. I would probably add one additional thing, which is what also has allowed us to do is partner with existing, you know, funds and existing bilateral donors. And, you know, one of the examples that I usually like to talk about, we have a hydro project in Nepal that required quite a lot of blended finance. We could bring the private sector window there, but, you know, the Asian Development Bank brought the Canadian funds that they had. We were able to bring the climate investment funds that we had and complement, really, you know, a project that was going to change potentially, you know, for a third of the population in the country, you make a huge difference about access to power. So, I mean, these are the kind of things that when you think about large scale, when you think about, you know, what else that you can do, and by giving us $2.5 billion, that's what the IDA PSW has been able to do. What I want to, you know, perhaps finalize with is that the complementarity of the other funds, in particular for climate, and Matthew mentioned the partnership with, you know, with Canada, with IFC also, we have had a partnership since 2011 that has allowed us to do a lot of things in the middle income countries that, you know, have the highest climate impact. And I think as we think of COVID and building back better, we will continue to need those partnerships that are beyond, you know, what we can do in the lowest income countries, in particular in the climate space.
Thank you, Kruska. Maciej, moving over to you before we go to the floor for more questions, maybe walk us through, you know, you're experts in Latin America and the Caribbean. Walk us through, you know, what is the current market? What's unfolding in climate blended finance in Latin America and Caribbean? And maybe provide us a couple examples, especially with you guys being one of the four on the forefront of blended finance in that area for climate. Matthew?
Thanks, Chris. That's a good question. And this is an interesting region. It's very unequal. You have fragile state countries like Haiti on one end of the spectrum, and then you have like countries that are members to the OECD on the other side of the spectrum. You also do have a lot of inequalities within countries, whether it's spatial inequality, think about a country like Brazil and the different states within Brazil, and also a lot of social and revenue inequalities. So that makes up for almost like an interesting lab scene for blended finance. And what we do see, and I kind of want to echo Kruskaya's point here, is that there's no one blended finance, but there's many different ways to do blended finance. And it's also going to be a function of the country you operate within. So for example, when you work in a country like Haiti, but also when you work in rural Mexico or rural Colombia, which we did recently with the Global Environment Facility, I'm going to agree with Kruskaya there that a lot has to do with the intrinsic bankability of the underlying transaction. So it's not really about nudging the company to do something. It's just that without those blended finance resources, that transaction wouldn't move forward. End of the story. And that's sort of almost like the old way of thinking about a blended finance. What's interesting is I think as we continue working with middle-income countries, I think we're probably moving a little bit away from this concept of, you know, binary interventionism, and blended finance really becomes an exercise in nudging. And by nudging, I mean, what can we incentivize the company to do or to achieve at the corporate level, so not necessarily at an individual project level, by providing a blended finance. And so a lot of what we've been doing recently, as soon as a couple of months ago, is, you know, working with larger companies that, you know, could very well finance themselves on the market, and we encourage them to do so. And where we use blended finance is really as a nudging mechanism, and it's a results-based nudging mechanism to incentivize them to go through certain milestones, again, on the corporate level. So in the case of La Vivienda in Colombia, for example, which is a fairly large institution there, the whole point of the blended finance intervention was to incentivize the company to think of climate risk. And I want to echo Rob's points there. So think of climate risk and subscribe to the principles of TCAD at the corporate level and sort of walk them through the journey, which is by no means obvious, even for a large company that is not used to factoring a climate resiliency consideration. And the other leg of the incentive was incentivizing the company to green their portfolio. What is interesting there is when you think in terms of return per unit of subsidy, impact return per unit of subsidy, it becomes very profitable, right? Because you're sort of decorrelated from the 10 million or 20 million you're borrowing to the company. What's at stake, it's really changed at the company level, and it becomes very good value for the buck, especially in the field of climate mitigation, where, you know, at the end of the day, it comes to how many tons of GHG emissions you're mitigating.
Thank you very much, Mathieu. I'm going to turn to the floor here for a question. Our colleague Mark Sen, I'm going to just read it out loud to everybody. Dealing with multilateral development banks and DFIs is relatively complex. For less experienced project developers, where does one go to assist with front-end deal structure? Is there a list of suggested and investment advisors? I just let you know, Mark, you could reach out to me directly. I would have an answer, a couple answers for you. But maybe, Rob, there, you know, just thinking about that question, you know, you guys support MDBs and DFIs, but none others. Like, I'm immediately thinking climate fund managers as a project developer that is taking on some projects that aren't quite right yet ready for MDBs and DFIs, you know, through Infraco Asia and Infraco Africa, Rob, there's some other names. Any other maybe names to answer Mark's question from your perspective, Rob?
So actually, I will turn this over to Mathieu and Kruskaya as well, because the reference to MDBs, DFIs. But actually, what I was going to do, Chris, was just reference the role that kind of Infraco Africa and Infraco Asia kind of play here. And the fact that there kind of are these kind of, you know, kind of project preparation facilities available, technical assistance, advisory facilities out there. The two, yeah, I'm just going to plug the ones that come to my mind. designed InfraCo Asia, InfraCo Africa, are absolutely designed to help support getting projects to the stage where they start to look of more interest to kind of the private sector, taking more of that early stage risk, helping them deal with the kind of the feasibility, pre-feasibility studies, that kind of very early stage stuff where the risk is greatest, and getting them up to the line towards kind of bankability and kind of financial close. So sorry, just a bit of a plug for some of our stuff there. But,
yeah, and also just, Mark, just to let you know, there's a group called PFAN that does a well above average job of trying to get support to these projects that aren't quite bankable yet, to get them bankable, and then ultimately, you know, hopefully even move them along to the point where MDBs and DFIs could be supporting them. I know, Kruskaya and Matthew, you face this question a lot. You see a lot of projects that aren't quite ready for MDB and DFI money. Could you steer Mark in the direction of some project prep facilities or something like that, Kruskaya?
I think, you know, Chris, a couple of perhaps points. First of all, I think as, you know, DFIs, we also have been thinking about this idea of how do we get earlier in the project development stage through our upstream efforts. Again, some of that is more earlier stage at this moment in time, and we need to see how that is going to change the way that we do business. But there is this idea of looking at markets that are not yet developed and trying to co-create some of these concepts and ideas. So this is one aspect that I think as DFIs we're trying to do ourselves, and IFC has put a lot of effort in the last, you know, couple of years to try to move that forward. I think the other thing, if I can think of a, you know, an example, and perhaps there are others in different markets, is we also have supported first-time fund managers. And, you know, those fund managers are then looking at the smaller opportunities there where they can invest. And usually, as you have mentioned, it will come with advisory services. So I'm thinking in particular, it's very particular, you know, this, we did something in Bangladesh, something in Nepal as well, where we work with these first-time fund managers. We have done also Pan-Africa, where then they are looking at that. In particular, the one in Nepal was looking at opportunities to invest in projects that had a climate resilience angle. So I think this is something that, you know, again, looking at where some of these investors are, I think looking at potentially some fund managers that are, you know, looking at opportunities, that might be another venue of support that they can get.
Thank you, Kruskaya. Now, I know, Fahim, I know the Canadian government is really big on helping a lot of these projects get developed at an early stage and getting them to a point where they can be funded by MDBs or DFI. Fahim, on behalf of the Canadian government or anything else, are you aware of anything that you want to add to the answer so far here?
Yeah, I think for our Canadian clients, and thanks for the question, we have the Trade Commissioner Service. So I have three other Trade Commissioner colleagues just focused on climate finance around the world in London and Abidjan and Manila. And, you know, we don't provide financing to the companies, but we definitely make the connections to the right people like Kruskaya and Mateo and Rob. And so we're happy to do that for our TCS clients. So that's a quick plug for us, but I think it's a useful tax paid initiative that the Canadian government is doing to support project developers.
Okay, guys, I encourage people to ask questions in the chat. I'm going to turn to our panelists now and ask a question from my perspective. Maybe we'll just do a rapid fire with Robert and then Kruskaya and then Matthew and come back to questions from the audience. Okay, could each of you kind of give your personal opinion in maybe two sentences on how the official development finance community comprising MDBs and DFIs and development agencies, donors like UKFCDO, what can they do differently to boost the supply of investment to ensure more climate projects can be financed? I think everyone would acknowledge that collectively you're doing a good to very good job. What can be done differently to get us from a very good to an excellent job? Maybe we'll start with you, Rob, and then Kruskaya, and then Matthew. Same question.
Thanks, Chris. I'm probably going to cheat by giving more than a couple of sentences, but I'll try and be very quick. So my first response actually is just to kind of welcome in particular Kruskaya and Matthew kind of being here with us today, because kind of my view is like the multilateral system, the kind of MDBs, DFIs, kind of absolutely front and center to kind of our response to this problem. These are the institutions that have the unique origination capability, the scale of finance that they can provide themselves, and then the kind of the leveraging that they can do. In a bit more detail, I think a couple of specific things. So when we're talking about mobilizing private investment, it's got to be on the basis that there are opportunities that are commercially viable. Investors don't know that if they don't have information and data. So more around market infrastructure, kind of more around kind of data to support the investors in coming in to make these decisions. And just as the final point, better coordination to make it easier for kind of everyone throughout project life cycles, from the developers through to the investors, to kind of be able to understand kind of the landscape, kind of what's on offer, bringing it together, better coordination, operating at scale. A lot more than two sentences, I'm sorry.
That's fine. We'll forgive you. Pruskaya, you still have at least two sentences then.
Very good. And I perhaps will reiterate what Rob is saying. Coordination, coherence in the way that we do things makes a lot of sense. There is a lot of work that needs to be done on the capacity building aspects of it, the advisory services. That requires grants. On many other things, we can have returnable capital, and that's what we do in many of the other transactions. But for upstream work, for advisory services, working together as DFIs, getting the support of, you know, basically government partners is also, you know, essential. So I will highlight that. The other thing is coordination within our own groups. And, you know, this is basically something that you mentioned the IDA private sector window has been pushing the World Bank group to do, which is, you know, there are aspects of the work that need to be about the neighboring environment, the policy reform. And we should be talking, you know, to the World Bank colleagues to make sure that when IFC comes, either on account or with blended finance, that that coordination has taken place. And in the context of FCS and fragile investing, we are also working very closely together with the other DFIs to try to make sure that we have a coordinated approach to some of the most difficult places.
Natia?
Right. I'm told to speak louder, so, you know, please make a sign if you don't hear me, because otherwise I see it in a chat once I'm done, which is sort of defeats the purpose. Yes, on coordination, but I think it comes with patience. And patients from the DORA community. We have a very interesting facility with the UK that actually puts a lot of emphasis on sort of the upstream work with the governments and how does that translate into a financeable project. But obviously, you know, you're talking about cycles that take a couple of years, and sort of really important to remember that, you know, perhaps those cycles are going to be longer than some of the traditional cycles when it comes to those facility. Yes, on grant for a technical facility, but grants and advisory comes with brain power. And I want to echo Mark points here in that, you know, I mentioned a transaction in Haiti that we closed at the end of last year. It took us 3 years to get it done. And believe me, not only we did use a TA and blended finance, but we actually did use a lot of our own in-house resources to make it work. And those are very expensive and unprofitable transactions from the perspective of the DFI. And you know, we can come up with as many vehicles that we want to de-risk. At the end of the day, if you don't have the brain power to structure a transaction and convince a financier to pay for it, you can throw as much money as you want. This is not going to change the equation.
Thank you very much, Matthew. We've got a question here from Basma Majerbi, and from what I understand, she's a finance professor at the University of Victoria. And Rob, if you're not aware of this, out of all the Canadian cities, this is probably our most British city. So if you've come to Canada and want to feel like you're at home, you need to go to Victoria, obviously named after, I guess, a famous monarch of yours. What recommendations do you have for academics, whether in research or teaching, to help advance blended finance for climate change? Maybe, Matthew, I'm going to start with you, because not only is Matthew one of the world's leading practitioners of blended finance, he's one of the world's leading thinkers trying to make this as academic an exercise between academia and practice. So maybe Mathieu, we'll start with you.
That's a good question. I'd go with one, the economics case for blended finance. You know, we talk about market failures, but, you know, I think this is something we could dig deeper. And, you know, there's a couple of hypotheses there. And sorry, I'm going to go with jargon. But, you know, one of the hypotheses we're having at IDB Invest is that unless you have a positive externality behind a blended finance transaction, it doesn't make a lot of sense to do blended finance. But on top of that, we also do think that the positive externality in and itself is not enough to do blended finance. And you need to either demonstrate that there's going to be knowledge spillovers associated to the transaction, or you need to be able to demonstrate that there's going to be increased return associated to the transaction. What Kruskaya was referring before as, you know, we're piloting a technology that right now may not be profitable, or we're in the club gold universe where you have a lot of setup costs. But once you've gone through those setup costs, the marginal cost of a new unit of product, be that, you know, be it a renewable energy farm or a forest replantation, decreases over time. So really on the economics case of blended finance, there's a ton of research to be done. Also on the additionality and blended finance, there was a very critical report coming out of the EU Parliament on sort of the case for ex ante additionality of blended finance. I think that's a great field of research. And finally, I would go with a social cost of SDGs. When we think about a concessionality and when we think about the level of concessionality in our transaction, it becomes much easier for us to do so if we sort of have a benchmark about the social price of that externality. So, you know, the US has a social cost of carbon around $70 per ton of GHG. That kind of metric is very important for us. And you know, they don't come out of our shops, they come out of the academic world.
Super, Mathieu, thank you. Maybe we'll move to Avril's question. Avril works at the Global Environment Facility. I'll read it out loud. And maybe we'll start with you, Rob. So if you can just think about this question. What role do you think blended finance plays in development areas beyond climate, such as nature, oceans, and land degradation? Are there special challenges in these areas that can be addressed by blended finance and attract the participation of private sector? Maybe, Rob, we'll start with your initial reflections and maybe move on to you, Kruskaya. Rob?
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Chris. So I guess just some kind of initial reflections on blended finance and these kind of types of areas. And I guess I would include, from a climate perspective, I would include adaptation and resilience in these types of areas as well. I think the issue here is the ability of finance in so climate adaptation and resilience, also nature, oceans, land degradation, for investments to deliver kind of revenue streams that are required for essentially the commercial viability kind of in the first place, right? And we've all kind of agreed that when we talk about blended finance, what we want to be doing is underpinning fundamentally kind of bankable projects. So I think the main comment I make here is I think that to my mind, the difficulty is demonstrating kind of bankability of investments. If we can do that, there's no reason why blended finance can't play a role in kind of bringing projects kind of across the line, mobilizing private climate finance, more generally, kind of as we've been talking about.
Super. Maybe Kruskaya?
Just to agree, again, you know, to Rob's point that if they are bankable, regardless of what is the area, then, or if we can prove the bankability, even with perhaps larger levels of concessionality, then the private sector will be interested. I think the other point that I will make, I think it's, you know, we are already seeing the potential for blue bonds that are thinking more about, you know, oceans. And I think there is quite a lot of great experience of what we have seen on the green bond side. But, you know, it will come with all the challenges of what do you measure? What do you report? How do you make sure that we are credible on some of these impact measurements? So that is, I with that, you know, Chris, you didn't come back to me with some of the research areas, but I do think that there is a lot of academics could help us on some of the subsidy, the theory behind providing subsidies. I think that's one of the area. And I think the other point, maybe on the social science aspects, anything about the nudging, the incentives, you know, the aspects that Matthew was speaking about, are we really making a difference when we are providing these results-based financing and performance-based incentives?
Thanks very much, Chris. And I'll just add to the point here to Avril's question. If you want to come back to us, Avril, we've mapped, you know, all of the blended finance transactions that fall under the climate umbrella. And as Rob rightly identifies, essentially mitigation. There's been a lot of mitigation projects that actually have underlying revenues, whether it's energy efficiency projects or whether it's renewable energy generation projects. Ultimately, these are producing revenues, less in the adaptation area, but increasingly in the nature, oceans, and land degradation area. If you want to follow up with us, give you some examples and maybe some broader statistics. And then secondly, Kruskai just mentioned the word, you know, kind of study of subsidy. At the core of blended finance, right, there's no ambition to quote unquote subsidize. What the ambition is to mobilize private investment to undertake something that they would otherwise not do, largely by creating, quote unquote, a market equivalent investment opportunity here. So we had a question here from who did it come from? I'm not entirely sure where it came from. It says, I think Alan Franklin said, quote unquote, subsidized rate. Who provides the subsidy? Does IDB provide financing at below market rates? Maybe we'll go directly there for you and Matthew at IDB. And maybe, Rob, I know it's a big issue for you guys at FCDO, this whole difference between subsidizing versus mobilizing. Maybe share some of your thoughts from a very important donor. But we'll start with you, Matthew, because I think, you know, this question, do you guys provide financing at below market rates, Matthew?
Thanks, Chris. So we, with our own capital, we only provide financing on a commercial basis. We do use third-party funds to provide financing on a concessional basis, which is, you know, the fancy word for subsidized financing. But I, you know, for me, there's no question that at the heart of blended finance, it's a subsidy. And, you know, it's nothing else. Now, we do it for certain reasons, which are the ones you've outlined. But we need to be conscious and mindful that at the end of the day, it is a subsidy that can achieve great things, but, you know, on the other end, can also generate risk that may be detrimental to market building. So it's, you know, I like to say that blended finance is not a discipline for the faint. You need to have a solid governance and institution behind you to undertake blended finance, because it can very quickly go out of control. Chris, perhaps I can just quickly piggyback on Avril's question, because it's sort of one of my pet areas, and we've actually done a number of projects with her, and she's ex-IDB Invest, so we know each other. But it's you know, I think of land degradation and nature-based solution as sort of the next frontier when it comes to blended finance in climate. And what we do see right now is that the business models are still not established. The additionality of blended finance at this point in time in the commercial cycle of those asset classes is really sort of getting a sense of what may work, and also experimenting on those different business models. Always with the assumptions, and that's the assumption that we take, that, you know, there might or there might not be a carbon credit to support those projects. And, you know, there can be carbon credit for forestry, but there can be carbon credits for oceans. So, you know, it's always about, okay, how can we think of a business model that is a profitable, that is associated with planting tree, basically. And, you know, it can be suitable pastoral models, it can be land restoration models that increase the productivity of the lands. I mean, there's a ton of different models, but where we are at this stage, it's really experimentation. And I think because of that, it's really important to be able to experiment. And you know, experiment might come out of Brazil, but it might come out of another country. So, you know, in order to be able to experiment, we sort of need to keep the field of experimentation fairly large, because we actually don't know where the nice deal that we want to test is going to be coming from.
And maybe Rob, you know, I think you guys at DFID and IFCDR have been one of the leading donors and development agencies thinking about this idea of minimizing subsidy and when does the subsidy become necessarily unnecessary. Maybe Rob, maybe give us some of your reflections from FCDO.
Yeah, sure. So just to start kind of with a very quick response to the question, you know, who provides the subsidy? So kind of ultimately, kind of most subsidy comes from kind of official development assistance. Like it's not the MDBs, DFIs, these are, you know, MDBs are banks, right? They can't afford to be in the position of dispensing concessional capital. And Mathieu and Chris Guy, I'd be pleased to hear that in my kind of work across the UK government in preparing for COP26 and around mobilization, there's this widespread misperception that kind of there's some de-risking required by institutional investors. Oh, the MDBs can just do it, right? They can provide the concessional capital. But I think, you know, there needs to be an understanding that's kind of not your role. Having said that, kind of like the donors, like for us, the official development assistance is kind of precious, right? So where we're deploying concessional capital to blend finance, we want to do that where we know it's going to be having kind of a maximum impact, where we know the subsidy is kind of the minimum kind of required, where it's temporary, where there's kind of a pathway out of that. And absolutely not about simply kind of subsidizing private finance into investments where there's no prospect of kind of bankability. Now, you know, there's plenty of things that will always require public financing, and that's fine. But let's not kind of confuse those with kind of the what blended finance is trying to achieve.
You know, in general, moving forward in the blended finance market, you know, maybe we'll start with Rob, then Kruskaya and Mathieu. You know, what is your last leading summary statement for all of us in today's session?
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Chris. So I guess just very quickly, just to kind of repeat the sentiment I was expressing there, just in my previous answer. So kind of blended finance has got to be about supporting bankable opportunities to commercial investment. And this is for two reasons. So one is because, you know, donors, we're kind of mean with our ODA. We want to make sure we're really deploying it in a way that gets maximum impact. And so we want to have minimum subsidy and to be leading towards commercial outcomes. But the real reason we want to focus on commercial viability, is that the real prize that I see through blended finance is kind of demonstrating kind of viable investment routes for private sector investment at scale into developing countries for climate solutions and kind of SDG investments more broadly. And that kind of demonstration effect, for that to take off at scale, it needs to be a kind of commercially viable, ultimately needs to be moving towards investments that don't require kind of a first loss concessional capital, that can sort of stand alone, kind of wash their face in their own right. So for me, that's the key message. That's the key purpose of blended finance.
Thank you, Rob. Maybe Kruskaya, then Mathieu. Kruskaya?
Thank you, Chris. And Rob, probably I will reiterate some of the points that you are making. I mean, you entrust this money to us, and, you know, Canada has done this in very large scale, you know, almost 600 million to us. Matthew also mentioned a lot additional. It's because you want us to help achieve more impact. And that impact comes, you know, with a lot of responsibility, because we need to ensure that we're bringing the private sector along, that we are looking at this idea of graduating at some point in time, so that, you know, we are creating and then developing markets and you are no longer needed. And I think that is what it is, you know, very important. And the other thing is you are allowing us to do it in many places, you know, whether it is, you know, Uzbekistan or whether it is Colombia or you know, or Zambia or you know, DRC. And I think all of that, if we think about, you know, the need to really come out of, you know, all the challenges we are seeing today with the pandemic in a way that it makes more sense, that we are more green. And, you know, now we are thinking about climate that is more inclusive. And Matthew spoke about, you know, the many inequalities that we see, and with climate resilience, that we are more resilient, that we can handle, you know, other challenges in the world. I think if we can use the promise of blended finance to do that in a responsible way that is not over-subsidizing, probably we would have achieved, you know, the objectives that you are entrusting us to have with these very precious resources.
Thank you, Kruska. Matija?
In agreement with everything that was said, so, you know, perhaps I'm going to go into the sectors as a way to complement. One, decarbonization. You know, renewable energy is becoming a commercially viable alternative. How do we phase out existing fossil fuel capacity? That's number one. Number two is electromobility and, generally speaking, energy efficiency. And I think there's a lot to do with blended finance in those areas. Number three is shifting the conversation in adaptation, perhaps away from this idea of the incremental cost of adaptation. I'm a big believer that adaptation is good business. It's a good investment. And perhaps move that conversation with the financial institutions, with the investors such as pension funds and an insurance company that have a vested interest in ensuring that their money on the asset side end up being invested in climate resilient investments. So how can we sort of shift or partly move the conversation to the supply of financing, because I sense this is probably where change is going to come from. And number four, and that's the last one, is how can we support countries in growing in a climate-friendly manner? So, you know, when you support Haiti in doing renewable energy, that's not going to change the carbon stock of the planet. But essentially, it's giving those countries the availability to still grow like others have grown in the past, but in a manner that is climate resilient.
Thank you very much, Matija. Really appreciate it. Well, listen, on behalf of the panel, I would really like to thank the Government of Canada, in particular Fahim and Laura Julie, for bringing us all together here today. And with that, I'm going to pass you back for concluding comments. Fahim?
Thank you. Thank you so much, Chris, Kruskaya, Rob, and Matteo. This was really, really informative session. And I think what we wanted to do was go beyond what is Blended Finance 101 and into this, some of the conversations that we did, even into academia. So I certainly learned a lot, and I've worked with all of you for a while. So this was really a great session for all of us. So not only did you illustrate the basic fundamentals of blended finance, but you also applied case studies, which I thought was really important, and emphasized the point that, you know, blended finance is one tool to get, but it's not a subsidy, like Rob said. It is a means to an end where eventually, like what we saw in renewable energy, it becomes commercially viable. So if for our audience, if you're interested in learning more about development finance institutions, and their approach to climate financing, I encourage you to listen to the Understanding Climate Finance podcast, where I interview investment officers, policymakers, and specialists from a number of DFIs. In fact, the podcast I did with Kruskaya released this morning on IFC's approach to blended finance. In our first podcast, or one of our first podcasts, was with Matteo and IDB Invests. It is in French, but we do have an English version that his colleague Pilar had done. So I encourage you all to download and listen, and it's available on all major platforms. So thank you, everyone, and I hope to see you tomorrow. And again, thank you to Chris and all of our panelists.